Podcast. In conversation with musicians from the UK jazz scene. And now your hosts, Rob Cope and Dan Farrant.
Hello and welcome to the Jazz Podcast. My name is Rob Cope, and as always, I'm sitting here with Dan Farrant. How's it going, Dan?
Very well, thanks, Rob.
Awesome.
Still, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. How many degrees is it there in Barcelona right now?
It's about 18 to 21. I think it gets up to about 20-something, early 20s today. Yeah, I'm not quite sure.
Well, we're rocking a 15. That could be worse. Okay. That's
not too bad for the UK, is it?
No, it's not. It's a high. I don't see any more 15s on the horizon. I think there's about three more shows until there's another 15.
Right. People didn't come here to hear about the weather, though, did they?
No, they did not. They came to hear about jazz. So, let's do it. Let's do the news. This week's news is more about, the future of the show. So, John Halliwell, who plays with Supertramp, in Supertramp.
Is he a sax player again?
Yeah, he's a kind of pop sax god. But he does some jazz playing. He's an improvising musician, Dan. So maybe we'll have to change the name of it for his show to the Improvising Podcast.
You're trying to sell this to me, aren't you, Rob?
Yeah, definitely. Because it would be cool to have him on. And Simon Willis-Croft, who plays with Duran Duran, he's a sax player.
These sound like pop groups to me, Rob. They don't sound like jazz groups.
Trust me, we want to have Simon on. The stories he'll have will just be out. It's no different than Loz.
Selling out for Jamie Cullum.
Yeah, exactly. That's all it is. There's no big deal.
Okay.
I'm going somewhere with these guests. We'll pepper them in. We'll have a nice talk. Mm. We'll hear some interesting stories. The thing is, at the core of it, they're jazz musicians who have gone down the pop route and become pop guys and had a career that way.
Are you saying that that's kind of inevitable for jazz musicians? That
if they want to make any money...
Right, okay.
I mean, I went to school with Simon, and yesterday I saw a picture of him flying to LA first class for a Duran Duran gig, and I was cycling around Southwest London.
So in your Lycra.
In my Lycra. So I think it's clear the sliding doors effect that a pop versus jazz career may have.
Okay. Well, why don't you write a little blog post on it on the...
That's a good idea. But we can examine it on our show. Okay. It would be very interesting.
Okay.
So anyway, those two names will add some gravitas to the whole operation.
Mine and your names don't? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, my name adds less gravitas. So Jonathan Silk has a big band called the Jonathan Silk Big Band.
It's original.
It's perfect, isn't it? And he has a new album called Fragment, which is out now, which you can buy now. And he texted me asking, would I want to play this mostly jazz festival in Birmingham in July?
Wait, hang on. You've got another gig?
I've got a gig. That's the news.
You've got another gig?
I've got another gig. It's coming in. I know. July, right? So my diary is obviously full because now...
Is this a result of the jazz podcast that you've got this gig?
No.
Are you starting to get favours in because you mentioned people's albums?
Yeah, but they all the favours exist in the parallel universe of Twitter only.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, so far they're not translating to the real world.
No, okay.
But hopefully they will.
Carry on. So you've got a gig in Birmingham.
Yeah, mostly jazz festival. Shaka Khan is headlining the festival.
Wow, right.
I know. So my plan is to email Shaka's people and be like, hey, check it out. We've got John Halliwell. You know, we got Simon Willis-Croft, you know, as an exception. I'd be willing to make an exception for her to come on the show if she'd be interested. Yeah.
Yeah, great. It happen, Rob.
Yeah.
Make it happen.
Well, we'll start a campaign, a two-man campaign, to see if we can get her on while we're up. That would be something. So Fragment's on Stony Rain. Oh, Fragment is on... Fragment is on Stony Lane Records. It was released last November. And I've gone on jonathansilk.co.uk where I can see it and listen to it. There's some cool stuff here. There's I haven't heard this one, the debut big band album with Percy Persglove as the guest is also there. Anyway, we've got nothing to do. Go and listen to it. But before you listen to that, let's listen to today's show with Dave Green.
Oh yeah, this was a good episode. I enjoyed this one.
Yeah, this was fun. Should we play it?
Do it.
So Dave, where did you grow up?
I grew up in northwest London, in Kingsbury. And I was born in 1942 in Edgware, just down the road.
Yep.
And lived there and through the war. I was, as I say, born in 42. After the war, in 1947, when I was 5 years old, we moved up to a prefab estate in Wembley Park, which my mum loved because it was these prefabs were fantastic. They were very modern, like little bungalows, you know.
Yeah.
And they had all mod cons.
Are these like little cubes that are stacked on top of each other?
Now, aren't they? Because of the housing shortage. Actually, really? They're talking about prefabs now, which is unbelievable, really. But they built whole loads of estates of these prefabs after the war, because of the bonding situation. And they were wonderful. They were little estates. They were lovely. Everywhere was exactly the same. Every building was the same, obviously. And it was like living on a... almost like a Butler's holiday camp. You know, it had a wonderful community spirit about these places, you know.
Yeah.
All the gardens were the same size.
Yeah, just like minus the miniature golf.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Nobody had anything more than anybody else. We were all bunged in together and it was fantastic, you know, we loved it. And I was 5 years old and who was my next door neighbour but Charlie Watts. Yeah. And so Charlie and I grew up together as neighbours. And we went in parallel, really, because it just so happened that we developed a love of jazz through listening to... I was a great, avid radio listener. Still am. I love the radio.
Any particular thing?
Well, at that time, my mum used to put on a programme. She said when I was about 2 or 3 years old, I used to listen to the radio then.
Yeah.
There was a programme called Music While You Work, which was on every day, and it was for the war workers, you know.
Right.
And it carried on after the war.
Yeah.
And I used to listen to that as a young kid and apparently sing along with it and everything.
Oh, you know? Wow.
And I remember she bought me a little toy xylophone. It was a Bangley xylophone. But as I say, Charlie and I, we sort of went along in a parallel way, discovering jazz through Glenn Miller.
Yeah.
Listened to the radio. I used to listen to the Glenn Miller band on the radio. I mean, it was after Glenn Miller died, but they repeated some of the shows, you know, on Radio Luxembourg. Listened to that, and then so I discovered jazz through listening to the radio, and then we started buying records, 78s, and I used to go in Charlie's bedroom next door, and he had a few 10-inch LPs, and we had 78s.
So he's in a free prefab too.
Prefab next to me,
exactly the same as your one.
Exactly, it's next door. Yeah,
great.
Yeah, and. So that went on, and we were discovering things like Jelly Roll Morton and Duke Ellington and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then that went on, and then right into our teenage years. We went to the same school together. He was a bit older than me, so he was a year ahead of me.
Yeah.
Were you playing an instrument by this time, or...?
I got involved with... Yeah, he got himself a little drum kit. This is when we were very early teens, I think, 13, 14. I got involved with the skiffle craze. There was a skiffle craze in the late 50s. Charlie wasn't involved with this little group that we had.
Skiffle's like a homemade instrument.
It was folk music, you know, folk music. Lonnie Donegan, do you remember that name?
No.
He did a record called Rock Island Line, which is a massive hit. Chris Barber played bass on that record,
right?
And it was a craze. It was homemade folk music. If you like, you know, usually washboard, two guitars, and a T-chest bass.
Yeah,
you made a bass out of a T-chest.
Yeah.
Literally, yeah. So I did that. I played T-chest bass in this skiffle group.
What do you use for strings?
Just one string.
Yeah,
yeah. And you had the broom handle, and you'd pull the change the note, pulling the, pulling the broom handle. And I got quite adept at this.
Is this related to like
very good teacher's face?
Fantastic! I wish we could have gotten one here.
Yeah.
Is this like because
I've got the photographs to prove it? Actually,
we'll have to.
Yeah, we will. We'll publish them everywhere. After the war, is this craze because there's not the resources to play a double bass, or would you be playing?
No, this is my, this is later. This is this was as I say, early fifties. Right.
I never really know how long that like hung over for, you know.
Well, it was a lot of austerity. Yeah. Oh yeah, sure.
Rations continued.
Austerity. Mm. Ration didn't finish till 1954.
Right.
Completely.
Yeah.
So early '50s, you know, it was still like an ounce. You could only have an ounce of cheese a week or something.
Yeah.
Or one or two eggs. It was really austerity time. So this went on for a few years. I lost my thread now. So,
Skiffle band.
Mm. So, but what I was going to say was that the Skiffle thing led into late '50s, led into the trad boom. There was that was another craze, you know, that sort of all of a sudden was everywhere. It was trad jazz, and this was why Charlie and I were teenagers, and around this time I'd. Our band was called the Zodiacs. Our little skiffle band was called the Zodiacs. And there was, we used to do little dances. We were like the interval group.
Cool.
You know. And opposite, and we did a couple of dances in church halls and stuff like that, you know. Opposite a band called the Zephyrs. Now, the Zephyrs and the Zodiacs, they were both cars.
Right.
Ford cars.
Right.
You know, it was a Ford Zephyr and a Ford Zodiac. It was a very, very original idea. But anyway, the bass player with the Zephyrs was a guy called Harvey Weston, who played a real bass. And I was fascinated by it. I wanted to play this bass. He was a good player, you know, very good player. And I just had to play a bass. It was just, I was drawn to the instrument. I was also, being at school, I had a very good music teacher who encouraged my liking of jazz as well. So that was very, very good for me at that period.
Yeah.
Of growing up and learning about music and all that stuff. And he was very encouraging about jazz music, which was fantastic.
Yeah.
He wanted to sell his bass, Harvey, so I bought his bass for £15.
15, wow.
15 quid, yeah. And and really taught myself to play. You know, I got a very cheap little book, How to Play the Double Bass, 25p.
Yeah.
Two and six. And learned some scales, you know, B-flat scales and stuff. Just taught myself how to play.
Yeah.
Listened to a lot of jazz records at that time, obviously, playing in my bedroom.
Yeah.
In prefab. And then Charlie would come in and we'd just play brushes and all that stuff. So we really taught ourselves to play, you know. And we'd been playing, I'd had the bass about not very long, maybe 6 weeks, 2 months or something. And we got the offer to join a local jazz band in Edgware. This guy called Brian Jones. And he was a nice trumpet player, actually, a very nice, good player, a good natural leader of the band. And so we had this audition in a pub in Hendon. And I don't know how we got through the audition, but we were very inexperienced players. We just loved the music.
Yeah.
I could barely play. I mean, I had good ears, but I managed to get through the audition. And I think he needed a bass player and a drummer, so he said, "Okay, guys, it's your gig." No.
Great.
And maybe he heard something in us that, you know, that we didn't hear ourselves. Anyway, so we started playing every Thursday in the Mason's Arms pub in Edgware.
Yeah.
This is when we were about 16, 17. And then that lasted, it must have been about a year. And then I started getting piano players would come down and offer me other little gigs, you know, little trio gigs. So I would go off and do these other little gigs, apart from the gig that we were doing in the pub. And Charlie was a he was studying art, and he got involved in that, and I think he went to Denmark for a while. He was going to art school, but then he dropped out of art school. This is probably a bit later. And I was doing my other little jazz gigs. That band broke up, by the way. The Brian Jazz Band. And so really, we went our separate ways. And Charlie started doing gigs with Alexis Corner and a band called Blues Incorporated.
Right.
And this would be now the, you know, early 60s, late 50s, early 60s. And I started doing more and more jazz gigs. So we went separate ways, and Johnny got involved in the R&B thing, and I got involved in more of the jazz thing. And we still have this marvelous bond, Charlie and I. You know,
of course, it's
fantastic. It's unbelievable. You can't sort of describe it. Because we knew each other from such a young age.
Yeah,
and we both went into this music, and he loves jazz, and he occasionally gets things together. We get together, you know, and we've had a big band with him. Mm-hmm. We've had a quintet with Peter King doing Charlie Parker music. Yeah. We've had all kinds of projects over the years that he's done. And I've been involved with them all, you know.
Yeah.
And that's a lifelong friendship, which is fantastic. Yeah. It goes on today, obviously, you know. You call me and say, oh, I picked up this signed photograph of Big Sid Catlett, you know, or something. Yeah, he's always searching out stuff like that.
Yeah.
And we're both collectors. I mean, he collects unbelievable stuff, but I'm a collector as well.
Right.
So, books and all kinds of stuff up in my loft, you know, old jazz magazines and stuff like that. So we've got this tremendous relationship, which is great, you know.
Yeah, that's something that, like you say, it's hard to describe to other musicians, you know, but it's, I think, probably something
it's
a lot
very, very special, you know.
Yeah, people have that bond with people they grew up playing with, or, you know, and there's no amount of tuition can replicate that kind of feeling, you
that's
know.
That's right.
But that's why we love jazz so much.
Yeah, of course.
So you've played with a huge list of musicians, including Benny Goodman, Coleman Hawkins, Ben Webster, Sonny Rollins. Did you have someone you, like, particularly among those guys, like, really enjoyed playing with?
It was not really. I can't. Well, I suppose I had a special relationship with Ben, I think.
Right.
Ben Webster. Because I played with Ben, with Stan Tracy, over a period of about 5 years, every time Ben would come into London to do Ronnie Scott's.
Yeah.
I did the gig every time he came in.
Yeah.
You know, so that was special, yeah. It was also special for me because my idol of the bass, the guy that I still think is an amazing bass player and a great inspiration to me, is Jimmy Blanton, who played with Duke Ellington's band in 1940-41. And Ben was in that band, and they were buddies.
Oh, wow.
You know?
Yeah, that's amazing.
So when I met Ben, it was just amazing for me, you know, because Blanton died very young. He died of TB.
Right.
He was about 23 when he died.
Oh, man.
But he was a phenomenal bass player. Yeah. He was a complete innovator on the bass. And he's still an inspiration today. He's an incredible player.
Yeah.
So that was very special for me to play with Ben.
Yeah.
To know that he knew Blanton. He told me little stories about Blanton and stuff, you know.
Yeah, sounds amazing.
That was great. I had a marvellous relationship with Roland Kirk as well.
Right.
That was very, very friendly. He was a very warm guy, you know. All of them, I mean, they were fantastic. I mean, in their own way. I mean, it was such a period for me. I mean, incredible. I mean, I was only about, well, I turned pro at 1963, and started playing at Ronnie Scott's in 64, really.
Yeah.
Doing little sets down there. I joined the Jimmy Duke and Keith Christie band, which was more or less the house band.
Yeah.
For about 6 months at Ronnie Scott's.
Yeah.
And I did that until Jimmy broke the band up and went to Germany. But about the same time, I joined Humphrey Lupton's band in 64.
Yeah, great.
So that took me away from the Ronnie Scott's scene, really.
Yeah.
I joined Humph. I did a tour with Buck Clayton and Big Joe Turner, which was fantastic. But then, at 66, Ronnie suddenly called me out of the blue. I hadn't been to the club for quite a while.
Yeah.
And he said, do you want to do a month with Roland Kirk? I mean, you know, it's an amazing opportunity for me. And it was wonderful. And that was the beginning of a fantastic period. And Humphrey Littleton was wonderful to me, really, because I was his regular bass player.
Yeah.
But he let me off. He gave me about 3 months off at one point. You know, he said, do what you want to do. And the band, the gig's yours. So,
yeah.
So I actually played in Ronnie's for about 3 straight months.
Yeah.
I did, first of all, Roland Kirk. And then I met Ben. Ben came in. And then it was like Zoot Sims and Al Cohen did a month. Sonny Rollins did a month.
A whole month at Ronnie?
We did a month, yeah. It wasn't a week. It was a month. It was
one
month.
Night, if you're lucky.
Yeah, I know. It was like a month. And then you did 2 weeks on the road. So it was like really 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And it was just amazing. You know, it was that, it was Zoo and Al, fantastic.
Yeah.
And then Roland came back. And this was 1966, 67,
yeah.
68. And then Hawkins came in, and that was just amazing. Yeah. Although when I first met him, I was going to say he was ill, but when I first met him, when he arrived, Hawkins, and that was unbelievable. You know, I mean, having played with Ben already,
yeah,
and then to play with Hawkins,
yeah.
I mean, Ben Webster idolized Colin Hawkins. Yeah. You know,
yeah.
I mean, there was a famous occasion where I hadn't long been driving. I hadn't bought a Ford Anglia, and I actually took. They were both staying at a hotel called the White House, adjacent to Regent's Park.
Right.
And I had Coleman Hawkins and Ben Webster in my car.
Wow, fantastic.
You know, dropped them off at the hotel. I know. Took them back to the hotel and then went back to the room with them. And I found out I had a recorder, you know.
Yeah.
They were talking about stories of when Hawkins came back from Europe because he was away Europe about 3 or 4 years. And, it's so funny. You know, great, great stories, you know.
Yeah.
Just, I was sitting there like a kid listening to these two giants, you know. It's amazing period. So the whole period for me was amazing. I can't really single out one or the other. I mean, it was just an amazing experience to be given that opportunity to play with these giant musicians.
Yeah,
I mean, if I'd been in the States, I would never have happened. No. You know, just I just through Ronnie Scott and Pete King giving me the opportunity, which was amazing thing for me.
Yeah,
I was only 25 years old.
Yeah,
to play with these giant musicians, it was just incredible, you know.
Yeah.
And I learned so much from that. It's something you can't pay for something like that.
Yeah,
it's just an experience of life.
Yeah,
that, you know. And it's to do with, I think I got on so well with them because I was, you know, I didn't have an attitude or anything. I just wanted to learn from them, and I was very giving in my attitude. I just wanted to play for them, you know. And so they kind of relaxed with me. I relaxed with them. And the incredible thing I learned from those guys was that as inexperienced, virtually, well, I was kind of an experienced player, just learning. But I felt that when I was playing with them, They were listening to you as much as you were listening to them.
Yeah,
they didn't have. That's why they're giant musicians. You know, they didn't have an attitude of going on the bandstand and just playing, irrespective of what the rhythm section was. They were playing with organically with you as well. that was an extraordinary thing. As great as those guys are or were, you felt that you were part of it.
Yeah.
You know, that they were, that, you know, there was one little thing with Hawkins, because I unfortunately couldn't do every night. So I had to put a dep in.
Yeah.
And who did I put in as a dep? Dave Holland. Yeah. He's amazing. Dave Holland, you know.
Yeah.
And Dave did a few depths for me with Hawkins.
Yeah.
But because I'd been playing with Hawk, we did the month.
Yeah.
There were little things that I did. I'd learned, you know, playing with him for the first 2 weeks. I learned to do with him, you know, like little things I did with him. And Hawk was drinking a lot of brandy at that time, so he may not have even known I wasn't there. Yeah. You know, Dave was a great player anyway. Yeah. But there were little things that I did behind him.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me, because I came in the next night after Dave had done one of the things, done one of the nights for me. He said, "I missed you last night."
Oh, amazing.
Not because of of what Dave was saying.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I'd done this little thing with him, that Dave didn't know to do, you know. So it's funny, just like a little ending thing, you know, something, whatever it was, you know. And the next, when I came in the next night, when I did it, he looked round at me, you know, "Hey, you know, there you are." So it was things like that. You had a relationship with the guys, you know.
Yeah.
And so, again, with Sonny Rollins as well, they're wonderful human beings.
Yeah.
Great people. I mean, Sonny, I've told this story many times. I was living at home with my mum at that time. And I'd go down and do a bit of shopping for my mum or something, you know, down the road. And I got back one particular day and mum said, "Oh, Sonny Rollins rang up, you know." "Oh, wow. What was the message?" No message. You know, just, I said, "How long did he have?" "Oh, he was on the phone for about an hour."
Amazing.
Wow.
Sonny Rollins, my mum. But you know, that was Sonny. Oh, I can imagine him, you know. "Oh, Mrs. Green, how are you?" You know, you know, chatting away. Brilliant.
I have a theory.
Great people.
That I'm sure is true about mothers, that once they've raised someone, they outrank everyone, regardless.
Yeah.
You know, I caught my mum once, like, I turned my back on her, and like when I was at college, Chris Potter came for a few days, and I turned my back, and I look back, and my mum is giving him advice on nappies, you know, and I was like, "Oh no, it was too late," and I could see Chris just taking it, and I thought, in life, she wins,
absolutely,
you know?
Absolutely. Mum always wins, yeah.
Yeah, so, it's fantastic.
I mean, I never had a conversation with him for an hour. Yeah, my mum did.
Yeah, of course. Of course she did.
What did your mum think about you becoming a professional musician? Was it? How did she?
Yeah, both my mum and dad were fine with it, because my mum knew that I was very musical from an early age, you know, listened to the radio. He said, "I'm along with the radio," and stuff. I always had a good ear. So she encouraged that. And my dad was a piano player.
Okay.
Not a professional player, but he used to play at parties in the manner of a guy called Charlie Coons, who was very popular in the 30s and 40s. And he played in that manner, very solo kind of popular song, not jazz, you know.
Yeah.
And so they were encouraging. Yeah, they really were. And they knew that Charlie and I had this thing going. And so they were fantastic.
Yeah.
I had an office job. I used to work in a ventilating company, Greenwood and Air Vac ventilating company. And I used to work there. I was doing gigs. I was doing little gigs. And, you know, I wasn't really interested. I was just waiting for something to happen, you know.
Yeah.
And a guy called Peter Shade called me one day and said, "Got this gig in the south of France. Do you want to do it?" I said, when do we go?" "Next week." "Okay, that was it. I just did it." Gave a notice in for a week, and that went.
Oh, great. Week's notice. Off
yeah, week's go. Notice. Boom. I was off, you know.
Yeah.
Because I was still at home. I had no ties.
Yeah.
You know.
How long did you work there?
I was there 3 years.
Right.
I mean, previous to that, when I left school, I left school at 15.
Yep. Yeah.
When I worked in the shop. But then I was starting to do gigs even then. So
yeah,
you know, it was always the first thing was playing. You know,
yeah, totally.
The job was just a secondary thing, really.
Yeah,
just did the job. And I got this job in an office rather than working in a shop, you know, and double the money. But I was still wasn't into it. It was just a stopgap thing. And I was very lucky because before I turned pro, I got involved with, I played in a lot in Ilford. There were a lot of jazz clubs, jazz pubs in Ilford. And I played with a lovely drummer called Peter Prince. He was older than me and a tremendous player. And Charlie liked him, actually. Charlie Watson liked his playing as well. He was a very good player. And I learned a lot from Peter playing with him. And I got to play, because we were the local rhythm section, you know, I got to play with Dick Morrissey and Don Mendel, Kathy Stobart, Joe Templey.
Yeah.
As a sort of 18-year-old, you know, 17, 18-year-old. And that was great. That was a really good experience for me. So before I turned pro, I'd had good experience of playing with some very good players.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like I was just jumping straight into the deep end, you know. I kind of had this experience of playing with very good musicians, you know.
Yeah.
So that was it. I felt I was semi on the way, sort of thing, you know, being self-taught.
Of course.
I mean, completely self-taught, and I was kind of worried about that. I took a couple of lessons from established bass players at that time.
Yeah.
Who were very encouraging, really.
That's great. Was there ever a point when you thought, like, maybe you've gone off, like, down a very dark alley?
I seemed to be getting on with guys. I always had reasonable time, good time.
Yeah.
Thing, good ears, you know, I was getting by. And, but I thought, I need a bit of technical help here, you know, just to sort of help me, just to put me in the right direction.
So. Yeah.
So there was a bass player that I really admired, Kenny Napper, who was a fantastic player. And I used to love watching him play. He had a wonderful technique. Everything was perfect, you know. I was just pretty ham-fisted, really. But he had this incredible technique. So I went to Kenny, thinking he was going to completely tear me apart, you know. But he was fantastic. He said, he said, play for me. So I played him, played something for him. Played blues or something. And he said, what are you worried about? You know, he could hear that I had a certain amount of natural talent, and my intonation was okay, you know, the time was okay, the sound was all right. He didn't want to sort of start saying, well, don't use the third finger on the left hand, you know.
Yeah.
He didn't want to hang me up with things like that. He just encouraged me and said, carry on, you know, basically, which was wonderful for me at an early age.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so I carried on more bad habits, you know.
Yeah.
Still do it today.
Yeah. So how's the scene changed over the years then to now? Because it's kind of nice, you talking about like playing in Ronnie's in the 60s. And like now it's 2016 and we're still 17. It's 2017. 17 now, sorry.
Right. Yeah.
And we're still sitting in Soho, you know. I say still, I guess Ronnie's has moved, but you know, there's been a lot of changes over the last, I don't know.
Yeah, it has changed. I'm probably a born optimist, you know. I try to be I'm very optimistic about the number of young guys
that
I'm playing. I play with some fantastic young musicians. Always have done, but there's still some wonderful guys coming out, you know, Sam Brasher and Will Arnold Forster, you know, young guitar player,
yeah,
and many others, great players. And so I'm very, you know, happy about that, happy about that sort of prospect of all these young guys coming on, but like we were saying earlier. Hope they can get some avenues and some things to do.
Yeah.
I mean, when I came around, it was... I mean, you could say this, you know, from a generational point of view. It was better when I was younger, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was different. It was different. It was a different scene. There seemed to be more places to play.
Yeah.
It was more of a jazz-orientated sort of culture. People seemed to, you know... come to listen to younger, there were younger audiences,
yeah,
for jazz, as I would describe the music.
Yeah,
you know? I mean, and all the great names were still around. You know, you can go and see Dizzy Gillespie. Dizzy would come over, right. Miles Davis, Monk,
yeah,
Duke Ellington. All these guys were touring, and they would play to packed houses when they came over. You know,
yeah.
So it was all this. That was a wonderful period to live through. It was just. You know, you can say, go and see. I played with some of these guys, which is incredible. But you
yeah.
could go and see these guys at Ronnie's. You
yeah.
know, the big old Dizzy had his band at Ronnie's.
Yeah.
You know, and Ronan Kirk later on had his own band.
Yeah.
So you could go and see concerts. Duke Ellington, you could go and see Duke Ellington, Count Basie. It was a different world. It was the whole culture. The whole thing was different.
Yeah.
Now that's pretty much past. All the great names, or not all of them, but a lot of them are no longer with us.
Yeah.
So it's a different world now. You know, that it seems to have gone off into different avenues. Everybody wants to make an impression, which is understandable. You know,
yeah.
people get into different things, and I'm not au fait with a lot of what's going on, you know, there's still guys like Dave Holland are doing some fantastic things. All those guys in the States. Joe Lovano's got a great band.
Yeah.
I did a gig recently with Peter Erskine.
Cool.
You know, I mean, wonderful, yeah. wonderful guitar player. I mean,
yeah.
incredible. It's,
yeah.
And it's, you know, the guys are still carrying on that great tradition in the States.
Yeah.
But there is this feeling to make some kind of, do something different, to make an impression in a different way,
yeah.
which is fine, you know. That's what, it's always been like that in
yeah.
jazz music, you know.
Yeah.
But I think probably the pressures are more prevalent today.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a pressure, I don't think there was pressure in those days.
Yeah.
It seemed to be a more relaxed situation. You come in and, I mean, I think one of the joys was having Ronnie Scott's in London.
Yeah.
With Ronnie Scott and Pete King.
Yeah.
That place felt like home.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm nothing against the present owners of Ronnie Scott's. It's still there.
Yeah.
And it's a great club.
Yeah.
But I remember it in the old days, and it was a different thing then, you know? It was different.
Yeah.
They ran the club differently. You played there for a month, as I say.
Yeah.
You don't play there for a month. You play one or two nights now.
Yeah.
And people are, you know, guys coming from the States, so don't play a week.
No.
Very rarely, I would say.
Yeah,
maybe one or two nights. But then it was like you play a month, and if you were the local band, you'd play a month as well, or you might play a week or 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Opposite these great names, so you felt more integrated in the scene.
Yeah,
I think it's got a bit more separated now.
Yeah,
and there's kind of a jazz celebrity angle to it.
Yeah.
Which I don't particularly like. I don't like celebrity anyway.
Yeah.
It's like a mixing of the genre, you know, somehow, with the pop situation or the image of what it should be, you
yeah.
know, which is different.
Yeah.
Because of where we are now, you know, as you say, 2017, we're living a different world with all those pressures and the effort to make some kind of impression,
yeah,
which isn't always good, but sometimes it's very good,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
but that's the way it is,
yeah. I guess there's less venues,
sense, yeah.
Oh absolutely, and less gigs, so there's more pressure if you have got a
yeah
gig,
there's
know?
Less play, that's probably what I'm trying to say, there are less places to play,
yeah,
there are far more places to play,
yeah,
because of the different
yeah
thing it was then, you
yeah
know? It was jazz was more integrated into media,
yeah,
you know, there was a regular live jazz program on the
yeah.
BBC,
yeah,
which was broadcast every week, you know. I did hundreds of jazz club broadcasts,
yeah,
in front of a live audience,
yeah.
I mean, that doesn't happen now, you know.
No.
This thing, Jazz on 3, you know, all these things that are there. What remains of the BBC still, you know,
yeah.
supports jazz. But I think they could do a lot more. I think it. I don't often recognise when I listen to Jazz on Three that it's actually jazz.
Yeah.
But I, you know, but it's just that probably just me. I mean, I'm 75 years old this year.
Yeah.
I'm hearing things differently. I'm relating to the past, how it was, and everything else.
Yeah.
Not to say I'm not open to what's happening. I still think I'm forward thinking.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of what comes out now is to do with the pressure of trying to make an impression.
Yeah.
And I think guys can sometimes get up little avenues, little cul-de-sacs, which don't go anywhere, you know, really. That's all I hear it sometimes. Yeah. Yeah.
So you had your own band as well.
I did,
yeah.
Were
you writing for that, or was it?
I'm not a writer, but I did write a couple of things, yeah. I wrote a couple of things. I had the trio with Ian Dixon and Gene Caldwell, which is great. I love those guys, and but I'm a lousy band leader, so it didn't last very long.
Yeah.
And I had a band in the late 70s called Fingers, which was two of my favourite players, Lowell Coxall and Bruce Turner, which people wouldn't have thought, hey, what's that, you know, Bruce Turner and Lowell Coxall, but they were fantastic together. They were great. They were both free thinkers.
Yeah.
And both kind of, in a way, pigeonholed by certain members of the jazz establishment, if you like, or jazz people, you know. Lowell was labelled as being a very free player, and Bruce was very kind of trad player, but he wasn't. He was a very free thinker, and they both were.
Yeah.
And I put them together, and it was fantastic.
Yeah.
It was lovely, you know. We did about 4 gigs.
So Ian Dixon, he's a saxophone player, which to me...
A wonderful saxophone player. Incredible, because I must say.
He's Yoda to me, you know? He's that level of ability. And also he's quite hard to find, you know, if you want. I used to try and track him down. I'd beg him for lessons, and he'd be like, "Nah, you can't have a lesson. We can have a beer, though, you know."
Yeah. Oh, no, he's amazing, yeah. Well, he was teaching. I don't know if he still is at the Royal Northern College of Music. Yeah.
He's teaching at Cheetham's School of Music, at the Royal Northern.
Oh, he was there at Royal Northern, he was there. But now he's at Cheetham's, that's right. Yeah, I mean, he's phenomenal.
I had some lessons with him there. And it's being a small school.
Oh, right.
All the cars used to be, they'd be parked like in the, like, you know, really small grounds in the middle of the city. Cars would be like on the playground. And one day I'm checking the notice board, you know, to see my name, Ian Dixon, 2:30. And I go down to the room and he's not there. And I go up to the, I go outside because I know which car is his because it's such a small school.
Mm.
No car. So I phone him, Ian, are you in today? I've got a lesson at 2:30, and you just went, oh, shit, I knew I had something to do today.
Oh,
yeah.
He's great. He's a one-off. He's fantastic.
So how did you come to that trio to choose Gene
and Ian? I heard they were sitting in the Pizza Express in London, and this would be, oh, dear, a few years ago now, the 90s. Yeah, maybe 96, 97. The then manager of the Pizza decided to have jazz jam sessions.
Right.
On a Friday, I think it was Friday and Saturday. Maybe it was just Saturday. After the main band had finished, you know. And I think I was here with Scott Hamilton.
Yeah.
And I decided to hang around. After the gig, you know, sort of midnight, and the other guys came in, set up, and
it's like a midnight till 3 kind
of
arrangement.
Midnight till 3, yeah, and started playing, and Gene was the drummer, and I thought, wow, this guy's fantastic. I just loved his playing. I thought, I've got to play with him.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
and I think I got his number and we exchanged numbers and stuff. And and I'd been playing with Ian. I first heard Ian up at the Appleby Jazz Festival. I forget who was playing with him. I can't remember who he was playing with now. It might have been Dave Newton. I loved his playing, you know. And then I got to play with Ian with the Kenny Baker dozen. I was very fortunate that Kenny Baker, who I loved, he was a phenomenal trumpet player, Kenny Baker,
yeah,
from a generation before me.
Right.
You know, he was with the Ted Heath Band in the 40s.
Oh, cool.
And he was an astonishing player, incredible. And a great jazz player. I loved his playing. And I was fortunate to be asked to join, as it was then known, as the Best of British Jazz Band or something, whatever it was called, Best of British. And Jack Parnell was on drums, and Brian Lemon was on piano, and it was a lovely band, you know. But I later on, Kenny had this, in the 50s, he had this band called Kenny Baker's Dozen, which broadcast on the radio all the time. And then later on, he reformed the band. And that's when I met Ian. I'm sure Ian had done a couple of those gigs.
Yeah.
And I met Ian on that band.
Yeah.
And I'd heard him at Appleby, and I had this, just had this idea, you know.
Yeah.
That time I got a band, that time I made a record. That's basically what it was.
Yeah.
I'd never made a record under my own name, and I thought, oh, no, I've got to do it. I've got to do it before I die, you know.
Yeah.
So I did it. We did it over a period of. We did some sessions, and then we had a break, and we did some more sessions. I mean, it took about 3 or 4 months to do it.
Yeah.
And we put it out, and I love it. I love the record. I just, cause, not for me, because I made a record with Ian Dixon,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
and Gene Caruso. It was just fantastic.
Yeah.
And they were great on that record. Amazing players. That was years ago. Yeah, it was about 1998.
Yeah,
that sounds about time I did another one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I did do one with Barry Green, a duo record. Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it was about a few years ago now, about 10 years ago now.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was nice too. Yeah, Barry's a great player.
Yeah.
Yeah, fantastic player.
Yeah, he's on our big list of.
Yeah, oh, you've got to do Barry, yeah.
You've got a monster.
Yeah, monster. Yeah.
So.
And Henry Lowther, you've got to do Henry Lowther.
Henry, yes.
Yeah, he's amazing. I'm with Henry's band, Still Waters, which is one of my favourite bands.
Yeah.
With Pete Hurt and Paul Clarvis.
Yeah. That's love those guys.
It's a very, very free band, you know. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
But things happen completely. You know, we don't work that often, but when we do, things happen differently all the time. It's just very, very organic and improvised, around Henry's writing, which is fantastic. You know?
Yeah,
yeah,
that's
love
really,
that band.
Yeah. Pete Hurt lives really close to me.
Pete Hurt, got to be Pete.
Yeah. I saw him on the train once, and I was like, "Hey, that's Pete Hurt." Yeah, I sort of went over to him, and I thought he'd like thought I was nuts for a few minutes. Well, I was like how on earth does like I guess like it's not that often on the train.
Yeah,
someone
would
come up to him and be like, "Hey, you're Pete Hurt."
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Once I explained myself, we had a very nice talk.
Great.
Have you got any advice for young players now, or for yourself if you were like 20 again? You know, you could give yourself some useful tips, some life advice.
Well, it's funny you should say that because I'm just telling the story the other day about a trumpet player who'd had a student, and the student asked him that question: "Have you got any advice? You can give me any advice, you know, about playing or what I should do?" And the trumpet player, this teacher, mm-hmm. I can't remember his name, he said, "Yeah, never take fours with Charlie Shavers." Which I think is great.
Yeah.
Charlie Shavers was a phenomenal player.
Right.
Yeah.
Don't never take fours with Charlie Shavers. That's the best advice I can give you. I don't know. All I can say is what I did.
Yeah.
Listen, watch and learn, you know.
Yeah.
Listen to records.
Yeah.
Watch guys play, go and see as many guys play as you can, you know. And absorb the music and
I'm taking away from this talk with you, Dave, is open-mindedness,
listening
absolutely. All the time,
it's always forward, it's always forward. Never, I mean, people ask me, I've got any stories about playing, I have got stories, you know, but I've got this fantastic sort of, went through this wonderful period of my own,
mm-hmm.
which is, but that's all inside me, but I'm still looking ahead, trying to think about getting better. I want to improve, and
yeah,
you know, listen to young guys, play with lots of young guys. And
yeah.
And it's just having an open attitude about the music, really. And,
yeah.
And that's it. Yeah, that's all I can say. Don't restrict yourself to any particular area of the music. I mean, I've always, growing up, go through my record collection. I've got records from, like, early Big Spiderbeck, Louis Armstrong.
Yeah.
Right through to late Coltrane. I loved Ornette Coleman.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, when I first heard Ornette Coleman in 1959, I was 17.
Yeah.
But I loved it straight away. For me, it was fantastic. It was just bluesy. It was just, to me, it seemed a natural extension of Charlie Parker.
Yeah.
You know, that's the way I heard it.
Yeah.
But a lot of guys with ingrained, maybe a lot of guys who, you know, tutored musicians or whatever you like, how you describe them, hated it.
Yeah.
They hated that kind of freedom. I mean, Dizzy Gillespie hated it.
I mean,
he's fair enough, you know. Which is surprising, because Dizzy...
Yeah.
You know, he was himself an innovator in 1945. But certainly, I remember Victor Feldman saying he hated it. Victor Feldman was a fantastic player.
Yeah.
So you have to respect their opinion.
Yeah,
obviously, definitely. You know, it's how you hear it, you know. Some guys that... some musicians are not ready for certain things, you know.
Yeah.
But in my naivety, pretty what it was, you know, as a teenager, you know, not being a school musician, or coming up through the big bands or anything else like that, I just loved it. I just loved the freedom. I just loved the whole vibe about it, you know.
Yeah.
And I've always loved free improvisation. You know, I've always that's why I used to love doing duos with Lowell Cockshill.
Yeah.
Just the two of us.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and Lowell had a grounding as well. Lowell had come up through trad bands.
Yeah.
But it's really to do with your attitude about music, you know.
Yeah.
Be completely open.
Yeah.
About everything. Don't reject it. It's good and bad in everything, you know.
Yeah.
Including some pop music. I like the Beatles, you know, some of the Beatles stuff. I love that. And before that, I loved rock and roll music. I loved Bill Haley's Comets when I was younger.
Yeah.
Just be open about it, you know.
Yeah.
Don't push anything aside. And some things are crap, but not everything.
That's great. Maybe that'll be the title of your episode. Some things are crap, but not everything.
Yeah.
So one last question for you. If you could only ever listen, I was thinking about this before, it's like the death row of CDs, like your last meal. But if you've got one last CD, you know, that you can listen to, and I'm, for no apparent reason at all, I'm restricting you to just one.
It's like Desert Island Discs.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah, exactly. Death row discs. What would you...
Death row discs.
Do you have any...
What time is it?
Yeah.
Death row discs.
Wow. That is just one CD, not one track.
You can take a whole album.
One CD. Wow. I think. See, it's. Do I go for Duke Blanton? Do I go for Bill Evans with Scott LaFaro?
Mm-hmm.
It might have to be Kind of Blue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because that's another one of my favourite bass players, Paul Chambers.
Yeah.
And the whole album is just amazing. The whole gamut of emotion and it's perfection.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many records that I love. I mean, you know, I could name another one.
Yeah, of course.
You know,
of course.
Or another one.
Yeah.
But probably that one, I would say, probably Kind of Blue. Yeah, it's pretty. I know it's probably an obvious choice, but
no, it's really interesting.
Miles is incredible. The sound of Miles is just amazing. And Coltrane and Cannibal on that album.
Yeah, it's a real.
The rhythm section, the whole thing is just amazing, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it'd probably be that one.
I love to ask that question because I think that with age, people's reaction to it changes quite a lot.
Yeah.
You know, I think. And obviously we don't have enough episodes to prove it yet. But generally, I think the younger you are, the quicker you answer. The quicker you're like, that one. That one album. You get more and more experience and it just becomes, hard to...
There's a few miles behind you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. No pun intended.
Yeah.
Well, Dave Green, it's been a pleasure having you on the show.
Pleasure to be here.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, that was a good episode. I enjoyed that.
Oh yeah, that was some of our finest work as hard hitting editors,
as journalists, wasn't it? As
yeah,
an internet media.
Yeah, there were some piercing questions.
Mm.
Dave sent me an email afterwards to say I quite enjoyed that.
Oh wow! Okay.
He said
calm
he was.
Down.
He
calm
said
down,
he.
Dave. Yeah, I know. Too excited.
That's an endorsement that I'm going to carry around for a long time.
When we get like some promo done, we could put that on as Dave Green got quite excited.
Yeah, yeah, it was okay.
I did enjoy. Did I'm not sure. I haven't heard the edit of this. So did the bit of him talking about his Sonny Rollins calling his mum.
Yeah.
Oh, it did. Good.
Oh, yeah. That's.
Oh, I enjoyed it.
You'll obviously have just heard it and have heard that story.
yeah. So that's going to be weird because, like, yeah.
Yeah, that's. No, that's a beauty. I love that story.
Sonny Rollins would call my mum.
Yeah, that would be something, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I'm just
kidding. I wouldn't put your mum past. Wouldn't put it past your mum to get Sonny Rollins' number.
Maybe I should set her to it. As a project.
It's like a nice little challenge for her.
Yeah. That's such a good idea. Right, going forward. Going right, forwards, mum. That's it, mum. The gauntlet's been laid down now. Go and get Sonny Rollins' number. Just, you know, see what you can do. And then get back to me. Because obviously, Sonny and Shaka, those are two that, you know, we should have an exempt list.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, if you do want a guest, by all means, get in touch with us. We are the Jazz Podcast. You can just Google it or tweet us or Facebook group us. There's lots of ways. I did read out my number on the air, but I can't remember if I left
that. Did you get any girls? Was Claire getting a bit jealous of all the, you know, the jazz groupies wanting to get hold of you?
Yeah, there's been a lot of traffic, let's say. You know, it's just been a busy couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Great.
Well, people are probably bored hearing us talk now, aren't they?
Well,
get on with their Friday.
But I'm just. There's one other thing I wanted to talk about.
Okay.
This show is a little on the short side. Hello, Claire.
Have we got time then just to waffle for a bit?
Yeah, we do. We've got plenty of time. So here's some things I want to tell you about. First of all, an actual plug. Let me see here. Mimica Orchestra are fundraising to make a new album. There's a link. I'm not really sure what to do with this link. Oh, I'm going to open it.
Why don't you read it out?
Yes, that's an excellent idea. If I've just typed in indie... Oh my God, the links... It's one of those links that's like four lines long, like four sentences. Oh, I've just found they're on £655 have been raised already by people just, you know, pledging and getting involved. I think this link is inappropriately long. I'll probably just tweet it and anyone that's curious about the album can go find it. Right, Mimica are making an album. They've got a link. They need some money. We're going to try and get some money for them.
Right.
Great. Okay. Nice work. It's over.
Until Friday thing. Oh, yeah. Is that becoming a thing?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
How did it become a thing?
From a podcast that I'm a massive fan of, that they will say the day of their next show. But of course, for us, it's always Friday, so it doesn't matter, but I wanted to do it anyway.
It's kind of like a Top Gear almost thing, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, it is a bit.
Am I allowed to say Top Gear?
Yeah, we can do that.
Yeah. Okay. Cool.
Sweet.
Do it. Are you doing the thing? Are you doing it?
I'll do it now.
Do it now. Go on. Do it.
Till Friday.